judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near. The court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Airman First Class Corey J. Lawback, number ACM 39396. In today's oral argument, we consider Airman First Class Lawback moved to dismiss the charge and its specification with prejudice for violating Article 10, Uniform Code of Military Justice. Even though the government violated Airman Lawback's rights, held him in pretrial confinement for 382 days, and took over a year to bring his case to trial, the military judge denied the motion. Did the military judge abuse her discretion? And the military judge found that the government violated Castigar versus United States when it used Airman Lawback's immunized statements against him. The government used the immunized statements to place Airman Lawback into pretrial confinement and in every aspect of Airman Lawback's court-martial. Was dismissal without prejudice a sufficient remedy? Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I request 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. You may proceed, and I would ask counsel for both sides to please speak clearly into the microphone for recording purposes.
Senior Judge Johnson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Dustin Wiseman, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Ortiz, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class Lawback. This case centers on a government Castigar violation that ultimately led to Airman Lawback spending 382 days in pretrial confinement in a segregation cell. The two issues involved in this case both revolve around violations of Airman Lawback's rights. The first issue deals with a violation of his right to speedy trial under Article 10, and the second issue deals with his right against self-incrimination under the U.S. Constitution. I'd like to address both of these assignments of error, but in reverse order, starting first with the Castigar ruling and the violation of Airman Lawback's Fifth Amendment privilege. The standard of review when looking at a military judge's remedy is abuse of discretion. And in this case, military judge number two made a ruling on the Castigar violation and ultimately dismissed it without prejudice after finding that the government had, quote, intentionally, quote, purposefully taken no care to cordon off Airman Lawback's immunized testimony and in fact used that testimony as part of a pretrial confinement hearing that led to Airman Lawback being confined. Despite his harsh findings of fact, and despite finding that
Right,
the government...
Can I stop you real quick, counsel? You said that the immunized testimony led to him being confined. Didn't the pretrial confinement officer indicate that he was going to keep him in confinement even before that information made its way into the report?
Well, Your Honor, the pretrial confinement review officer, there's a couple problems with his testimony. But to answer Your Honor's question first, he said that there were multiple things that led him to holding him there. One was the fact that the gun incident had happened and he found that there was enough evidence that that had happened. The second is this information about drug use. And the third is this allegation of a sexual assault. So it was those things, three things together that he ultimately relied upon. Although there are parts of his testimony where it sounds like he may have confined him based solely on the gun offense, military judge number one, when he ultimately reviewed the pretrial confinement hearing, found that that alone would have been insufficient to confine Airman Lawback based solely on the gun offense. Because there was, as he found in his ruling, there was an insufficient evidence that Airman Lawback would either be a flight risk or would continue to engage in misconduct at that point in time. Second is there are significant credibility issues related to the PCRO's testimony. As military judge number one put it in his ruling, he found it incredible certain things that the PCRO testified to, and to quote military judge number two, he said that something is rotten in the state of Denmark, as Shakespeare might say, in regards to what the PCRO testified to. So, Your Honor, he may have said that, but military judge number one clearly indicated that that would not have been a sufficient basis on its own to confine him.
Counsel, the government had some information about drug use even before they granted him immunity, isn't that true?
They had general allegations that Airman Laubeck was around people who had used drugs, but in the government's own words in their immunity request, it was not enough to move forward prosecuting him. And that's what military judge number one ultimately found in his findings of fact, is that there was insufficient evidence to find that Airman Laubeck had done that. But it was based upon that information that they ultimately sought the immunity, and then they revived that investigation after the gun incident happened in September. So they, in essence, used that information they got from the immunity and started up this new investigation into drugs, which is how it ended up in the report, is you had a government representative at the PCRO hearing who was then drafting the PCRO's report, and then the PCRO is accepting that report without changing a word of what the government representative drafted. A government representative who included in testimony related to my client's immunity deal. So that's why military judge number one ultimately said this would not have been sufficient on its own to confine him at that point of time, which ultimately led to military judge number two saying this use was improper because the government here purposely didn't take any steps to cordon off this immunity. And the reason why they didn't take any steps to cordon it off is they thought it was okay. There's testimony from the SJA, the base level SJA, saying, well, I talked it through with my NAF SJA, and because our stance is it's an administrative proceeding, we're allowed to use it. All the while, the ADC is objecting to this use, and the government's doing it anyhow. Even the accused commander testified that he had concerns about the use of this immunized testimony at the PCRO and during the preferral and referral process, but that his concerns were allayed by the base level staff judge advocate who told him that it was an acceptable thing to do.
But why isn't the remedy that Military Judge 3 provided with regard to granting credit based on the PCRO's actions, why isn't that a sufficient remedy for these violations?
Well, Your Honor, we have to look at what the credit was remedying. So what the credit was remedying was Airman Laubeck being confined and having by a PCRO who was not neutral and detached, who was not unbiased. So it was a RCM 305 credit because the PCRO was not neutral and detached like he was supposed to be. So that's what the credit was meant to remedy. It did not remedy the Castigar violation. That was never remedied.
Wasn't it remedied by the dismissal without prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what I was getting to. It was never remedied until military judge number two came along and said, this has infected every stage of the proceeding. This needs to be dismissed. Now, the defense requested that it be dismissed with prejudice. And ultimately, they got an indication that military judge number two was not going to go that far. And so they did what most trial practitioners do, and they sought the remedy that they could get at the judge, which was dismissal without prejudice. But the problem with that remedy is that if you look to cases like Sawyer, which is cited in the appellant's brief, and Lewis, both cases which deal with unlawful command influence and having military judges removed, those two cases have points of law that talk about how a remedy, one, is meant to actually remedy the harm that the accused suffered, and two, serve as a deterrent for the government's misconduct, not to allow the government to, in essence, profit from the misconduct that it engaged in. And here you've got findings of fact that the government purposefully engaged in this conduct because they thought that it would enable them to throw Airman Laubeck into pretrial confinement. Regardless of whether or not that's what the PCR ultimately relied upon, that was their intention. And so they profited because, in fact, Airman Laubeck was placed into pretrial confinement. And by dismissing the charges and the specifications without prejudice, military judge number two, in essence, did nothing to the government. The government profited by getting Airman Laubeck into pretrial confinement and suffered no hindrance in moving forward with their case. They simply had to let a different office region up the case. The problem is, what Airman Laubeck won was he won another 175 days in jail and pretrial confinement in his segregation cell. So this is a situation where the remedy not only does no harm to the government, no sanction to the government, but actually harms my client, even though it was the government who violated his rights. And that's why military judges number two's decision to dismiss it without prejudice was an abuse of discretion, because it does not fall in line with Sawyer and Lewis and the discussions that CAF has in those cases about the remedy actually being a remedy.
Is there any indication that the Castigar violation infected the second proceeding in some way?
Not as it relates to the findings. So my client intended to plead guilty from day one. He took ownership of it moments after he shot his friend by accident. So this isn't a situation where the findings were ever in doubt. So it obviously wouldn't affect the findings. It did end up affecting the sentencing in a negative way, which also ties into the fourth Barker factor when I get to the second part of my argument under prejudice, which is that at the time this case was supposed to go to trial, the victim in this case did not want to participate. In fact, he submitted a memorandum, which is attachment 19 to the original appellate exhibit 1, dated October of 2016, where he says, I don't want anything to do with this case, period. But fast forward about a year later, when this case actually gets to trial, now he's willing to participate, and in fact does so, and provides pretty damning testimony on my against my client about the effect this offense has had on him. And so it did end up affecting my client, because now you've got this the victim of the offense testifying in court when he had indicated initially that he was not going to do so, because the government ended up getting that delay. Turning to the second assignment of error, which is the Article 10 violation, this court reviews Article 10 violations de novo. Now, when it comes to the military judge's findings of fact, this court gives substantial deference to those unless they're clearly erroneous, but the ultimate issue about whether Article 10 has been violated is an issue reviewed de novo. It's helpful when looking at Article 10 to understand what the purpose is, and CAF lays that out in United States versus Cooley, a 2016 case. And they say, quote, Article 10 is designed to ensure that the accused knows the reason for the restraint of his liberty and to protect him while under restraint from unreasonable or oppressive delay in disposing of a charge of alleged wrongdoing either by trial or by dismissal, end quote. And then, quote, it is the government's responsibility to provide evidence showing the actions necessitated and executed in a particular case justified delay when an accused was in pretrial confinement, end quote. And in determining whether or not those purposes of Article 10 are satisfied, there are four prongs which are laid out in United States versus Barker. And the first one relates to the length of the delay. Now, the length of the delay in this case, as the government concedes, was approximately 275 days. I could spend most of this argument arguing back and forth about why that number is actually greater than 275 days. Most of these arguments are already made in the brief, but it's sufficient to say that even accepting the government's position that 275 days were due to the government, it's clear that 275 days on its own is problematic when you're looking at Article 10, especially when you look at cases like Cooley from CAF, the Navy case in Miller, and the Navy case in Callaway, where the amount of time involved in those cases is either similar or much less. When you're talking about Cooley, it's 289 days in that case, 140 in Miller, and 115 in Callaway. And in all three of those cases, the appellate court found that not only did that factor weigh in favor of the accused, but that that length of the delay ultimately resulted in an Article 10 violation. When looking at the length of delay, this court, as CAF said, quote, should include the seriousness of the offense, the complexity of the case, the availability of the proof, and additional circumstances, including whether appellant was informed of the accusations against him, whether the government complied with procedures relating to pretrial confinement, and whether the government was responsive to requests for reconsideration of pretrial confinement. That's telling in this case that CAF found that those issues were important because all of those issues went awry in this case. You've got a situation where my client was put into pretrial confinement and was not informed of the charges against him until 60 days after he was placed there. He didn't know what he was charged with for 60 days as he sat in a segregation cell. CAF also says this court's supposed to consider whether the government complied with pretrial confinement procedures. Well, the answer to that is readily apparent. They didn't. In fact, it was so bad that my client received over 6 months worth of credit off his sentence because the government didn't comply with RCM 305. And then CAF tells this court that it's to consider the government's responsiveness to requests. Well, here you've got evidence in original appellate exhibit 1, attachments 13, 14, 20, 23, and 25, that not only was the Area Defense Council objecting via email, he worked with the client to submit Article 138 complaints, all contesting the pretrial confinement and requesting evidence and requesting the charges. And the government's response was silence or denial. Yet despite these facts, military judge number 3 found that the Barker factors, the full Barker analysis, wasn't even triggered. Wasn't even triggered. And ultimately found that the length of the delay factor weighed heavily in favor of the government. Even though this court isn't required to give that conclusion of law any deference, this court, even if it was under a more deferential standard, shouldn't give that ultimate conclusion deference because it's clearly against the facts of this case. Both the government's brief and military judge number 3 view this case as two separate trials, and they view them as separate trial. Trial 1 generally went according to plan, and trial 2 generally went according to plan. But the problem with that is that ignores the bigger picture, that trial 2 in total, which took an additional 175 days, was due solely to the government's Castigar violation. Solely. Whatever delays may have been involved in trial number 1, when March of 2017 came around, my client was ready and prepared to plead guilty in March of 2017. And the only reason he couldn't or did not is because the case had to be restarted because of a government Castigar violation. You add into that 175 days the 60 days it took for them to inform him of the charges against him by preferral and the other miscellaneous charges because people weren't available or just things take a while. And that delay becomes more and more unreasonable, which gets to factor number 2 in the Barker analysis, which is the reasons for the delay. And the reasons for the delay in this case in some ways are simple, but in some ways remain unexplained. They're simple in that the vast majority of the delay is due to a Castigar violation. But then the record isn't clear why it took 60 days for my client to be preferred upon. Now, the record indicates that the government was looking into additional charges, this drug offense and the sexual assault allegation, but they had all the evidence on the sexual assault allegation at the time of the PCRO hearing. They had already talked to the person who was making the allegation, which was an airman who my client had provided testimony against, and they had already gotten word from the locals that they spoke to the victim, and she said it was consensual. And OSI never even went out to interview her, never opened a full investigation. So that couldn't have been the reason it took 60 days.
Now, counsel, I understand your argument about it taking 60 days, and a similar thing has happened in other cases like Scala and Wilson where it took a long time, and the court expressed concern about that waiting posture, but it ultimately didn't find that it was enough to warrant an Article 10 violation, at least that factor alone, because constant motion is not required. So what's your response to that?
Your Honor, I agree. Constant motion isn't required, and even if that factor was strong, it doesn't mean you're going to prevail in an Article 10 violation. But one of the distinguishing factors, which I think makes this case different from those cases, is you're talking about the complexity of the case. That's one of the factors CAF says to consider, is the complexity of the case and the availability of evidence. Here, you've got my client who calls 911 and says, I shot my friend in the stomach. You've got my client admitting to police the next day with OSI there at the interview. You've got all the forensic evidence already gathered. This case was investigated and done within days of the actual incident happening. This isn't a case where there's witness availability or there's wants of proof. It was all there. So for those reasons, this court should find that the second factor weighs heavily in favor of my client, because to do otherwise would be to say that engaging in a CASCAR violation is reasonable diligence, because that's ultimately what factor two asks, is did the government proceed with reasonable diligence? And the government intentionally using information my client provided under immunity against him, causing additional delays, is not reasonable diligence. And I think holding so only sanctions the government's approach. Turning to the third factor, which is whether or not my client made speedy trial demands, military judge number three said that, quote, it would appear, end quote, this factor weighs in favor of the accused. Make no doubt, this factor weighs in favor of Airman Laubach. He made three speedy trial demands, two during the first part of the trial and one during the second trial lead up. So this factor clearly weighs heavily in favor of my client. And then the third factor is prejudice. Now, I want to start off by reciting CAF's view of prejudice, which is that it's a factor to be considered. It is not a requirement to find an Article 10 violation. And in this case, there happens to be significant prejudice, but this court need not even find any prejudice as long as it finds that the other factors weigh in favor of the Article 10 violation. And that's ultimately what the Navy CCA did in a case called called Miller, where there were no speedy trial demands and they found no prejudice, yet still found an Article 10 violation.
Counsel, can you identify another case besides Miller where there was essentially no prejudice identified, but an Article 10 violation was identified?
So Miller is the only case where they explicitly say absolutely no prejudice. But I'll point this court to Cooley, which is the CAF case from 2016, because there CAF says there was prejudice, but it was minimal. So the prejudice in that case was there was a delay, and the accused in that case got delayed expert assistance. And the court says several times, as minimal as that may be, it's sufficient to tip the scales in that case to find an Article 10 violation.
So there was prejudice.
There was, but it was minimal. Miller, to answer your question, Your Honor, is the only case that I'm aware of where a court specifically says there's no prejudice. But CAF time and time again says prejudice isn't a requirement. To tie into Cooley even further, Cooley is a case where there was 289 days of delay, but what's also telling about Cooley is there was no government misconduct. And there, as in this case, like with the CASTIGAR violation, and the ultimate amount of time it took them to get him to trial was 289 days, where in this case, my client was in jail 382 days in pretrial confinement. So while Cooley may have been a close call and that minimum prejudice tipped the balance, there's also much more aggravating factors in this case, specifically the much longer length of confinement and the fact that the length was in large part due to government misconduct. Turning to prejudice in this case, one of the main prejudice my client suffered is he spent 382 days in pretrial confinement. And because it was pretrial confinement as opposed to post-trial confinement, that caused significant harm to him. First, it meant that because he was the only maximum security inmate at that facility and the rest were medium, and he couldn't be commingled with the two, that he was held in a segregation cell the entire length of his confinement. That means he was by himself. The second is he was ineligible for work details. Another is that he had no ability to get sentencing credit off his time of confinement, and he had no access to treatment courses or education opportunities.
Could you back up? What do you mean by he had no opportunity to get sentencing credit off of his time?
So he had no ability to engage in work details or to go to counseling or things like that that would have given him time off his sentence.
Okay.
The second way that he was prejudiced was that he had an unusual amount of anxiety and fear. And that's because normally when a pretrial confinee or somebody goes to jail, they know what they've been charged with or they know what they've been convicted of, and there's some solace in knowing at least where they stand. My client had to sit in pretrial confinement for 60 days, of which he didn't even know he was charged with. And he had to sit in pretrial confinement knowing that the PCRO was getting his report from the legal office. He had to sit in confinement knowing that the government was using his immunized testimony against him, not ultimately knowing whether or not he'd have to defend himself in court against statements that he made under immunity. And he didn't know what was going to happen with these other charges, what was going to happen with the sexual assault allegation and the drug offense. But most importantly, I'll turn back to what I talked about at the beginning, which is he was prejudiced because at sentencing, the government now had a witness to bludgeon him with, the victim of the crime, that who in October of 2016 had indicated they did not want to participate. So because of that delay, not only did the government profit by getting my client put in pretrial confinement by violating Castigar, they ultimately profited from the delay because now they had the victim who was now willing to testify, who wasn't willing to testify earlier. For these reasons, this court should find, when reviewing the case, that both military judge number one, or judge number two, abused his discretion in granting his remedy, and or find that military judge number three was wrong when she ruled against my client in finding that there was no Article 10 violation, because not only do the first three factors, Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. May I briefly conclude?
You may, and I have one brief follow-up question.
Yes, Your Honor. But should also find that all the Barker factors weigh heavily in favor of my client and thus rule that this case should be dismissed with prejudice.
All right, counsel, is it your understanding that at the time of the March 17 proceedings, the victim was still unwilling to cooperate?
Your Honor, the record does not specify when that changed. So the record is silent on that. The only two points that we have are that in October, the victim wants no involvement in the case. Then come September of the next year, the victim is on the stand, or is making an unsworn statement. I will point this court's attention to what CAFA said in Cooley, which is that when you're talking about Article 10, it's not the accused's responsibility to disprove that he was prejudiced. It's actually the government's responsibility to prove that he was not prejudiced by this delay. And so to the extent that there is any doubt about whether that would have changed in time to make a difference, this court is bound to take the view, since the record is silent on that, in favor of my client.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Senior Judge Johnson, Judge Lewis, and Judge Dennis. May it please the court. I'm Captain Peter Kellett, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States in this proceeding. Appellant is not entitled to further relief for use of immunized testimony because the claim was waived at trial, and even assuming if it was not waived, he was provided with the appropriate relief by the military judge. Also, appellant is not entitled to relief under his Article 10 claim because the government moved with reasonable diligence to bring him to trial. First, I'd like to address, much like the appellant's counsel, the immunized testimony claim first, and then I'll move to the Article 10 claim. And from the outset, I just want to make it clear that no one is saying, neither appellant nor the government, or at trial or here on appeal, is saying that the use of the immunized testimony affected the substantive evidence at the second trial, meaning the charge dealing with the aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. What we're talking about is whether or not the immunized testimony affected the preferral and the referral. So essentially what we're dealing with is whether or not it was a proper preferral and referral, procedural steps in the process. And that's why the dismissal without prejudice was an appropriate remedy. And there's no argument or reasonable argument to be made that the use of the immunized testimony is the only thing that tipped the scales in the convening authorities' minds to proceed to trial in this case. Because ultimately what we're talking about is aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, and the immunized testimony dealt with the use of mushrooms. So there's no way that that is what caused the convening authorities or anyone in the step of the process to proceed but just using use of mushrooms testimony. But first, turning to waiver, appellant cites to RCM 910J to support his argument that an unconditional plea of guilty only applies to factual issues of guilt, but CAF, our Superior Court most recently addressed this in United States v. Hardy last year and said that while 910J does talk about factual issues of guilt, that is not the only relevant rule that we're concerned with when dealing with waiver, especially with an unconditional guilty plea. And they pointed to the same language that's pointed out in Bradley, which is cited in the brief, in the government's brief. And it states, an unconditional guilty plea waives all non-jurisdictional defects at earlier stages of the proceedings. And that's what we have here. The immunized testimony issue is a non-jurisdictional defect. So based on the language in Bradley and in CAF's language in Hardy, this was waived at trial when the appellant unconditionally pled guilty. And also, appellant hasn't cited anything saying that a remedy can be reviewed afterwards, but Bradley pretty squarely addresses that point, that even the requested alternate remedy of disqualifying trial counsel based on the immunized testimony also could not be reviewed despite what the lower court found. And finally, any argument that it could not be waived is also inconsistent with RCM 910B2D, which basically says immunized testimony issues are a waivable ground. So the requirements of RCM 910A2 not being satisfied, which is the requirements to secure a conditional guilty plea, means that appellant waived his claim as to the immunized testimony when he pled guilty. But even if there is no waiver, dismissal without prejudice was the appropriate remedy, as I previously discussed. And it's important to consider the purpose of immunity and the protection surrounding it. And basically, Castigar, citing the language in Castigar, the use immunity is intended to leave the witness and the prosecutorial authorities in substantially the same position as if the witnesses had claimed the Fifth Amendment privilege. Simply put, the law on immunized testimony, the focus is to root out any taint from using immunized testimony. And in this case, we don't have the normal scenario where the use of the immunized testimony was exploited to gather substantive evidence to prove aggravated assault. It was used improperly, improperly placed in the preferral package, which led ultimately to preferral and referral. Now, the government doesn't...
Counsel, you say improperly placed as if it was some sort of inadvertent mistake. Do you agree that it was an intentional decision by the government at many levels to include this immunized testimony?
Yes, Judge Lewis, obviously there were several layers of a review where it could have been caught and people recognized that it was there. But the government is not conceding that it actually led to the preferral and referral. Now, while that doesn't ultimately matter because the judge dismissed it without prejudice anyway, and we're not asking the court to review whether or not that was proper. That did occur, yes, Your Honor, but the government's position is that it didn't actually affect the proceedings. In fact, the military judge found that the convening authorities did not review that evidence when making their ultimate decisions. Also, none of this evidence of the immunized testimony was presented at the Article 32 hearing the first time around. Having said that, the dismissal without prejudice effectively cured this because as our jurisprudence has shown or has consistently said, dismissal with prejudice is an extreme remedy. And when there's another remedy that can render the error harmless, that is the preferred course. And the dismissal without prejudice effectively cured it. And I would point this court's attention to United States v. Mapes and Cunningham versus Gilovich, which are both cited in the briefs. And in Mapes, CAF found that several charges in the appellate's court-martial were based upon tainted evidence from the use of immunized testimony. However, CAF found that two specifications were not based upon the tainted evidence. Basically, that substantive evidence was not going to be used for two specifications that was tainted. Having said that, CAF still found that the immunized statements still probably played a part in the preferral and referral for those two specifications they found were not tainted. So instead of dismissing the entire case with prejudice, CAF set aside and dismissed with prejudice those charges and specifications they found to have been tainted substantively, and set aside the remaining specifications and told, basically in their order, said that the convening authority can re-initiate this case, but they have to make sure that whoever reviews the case and makes those decisions reviews the case without the tainted evidence. So essentially, the appropriate remedy in that case was dismissal without prejudice as to the specifications that only were improperly preferred and referred, as is the case here. And also in Cunningham, a similar situation occurred where there wasn't an immunity in that case, but there was this discussion of de facto immunity where essentially the appellant's insubstantial reliance of a promise of immunity gave statements. There, the Court of Military Appeals found that a new member of the command must review the case without the untainted evidence in it, and they could proceed towards trial because, again, in that case, they found that that was the more appropriate remedy than dismissal without prejudice.
So, counsel, how do you respond to appellant's argument that, as a practical matter, the government profited from its behavior here based on the victim's subsequent participation?
So, Your Honor, when talking about profit, I think it's important to look at the language of Salyer, which is the case that appellant relies on when they talk about profiting. And in that case, again, it was about the government trying to disqualify a military judge because they wanted another military judge to preside over the case. So through their misconduct, they were ultimately able to secure another military judge. And the court found that dismissal without prejudice was not appropriate because doing that would ultimately allow them to do what they wanted, which is secure another military judge. In this case, we don't have that issue. The government would not profit by being able to have an improper preferral or referral. What we're worried about here is essentially that, the procedural steps taken to get to trial. The remedy, dismissal without prejudice, caused the government to do a proper referral, preferral and referral, meaning that they did not get to trial improperly. So they did not profit from putting immunized testimony in the preferral package and letting it go through these different stages, as Judge Lewis pointed out, and get to trial improperly. So and that's why this case is distinguishable from Salyer. In addition, not only did the government have to redo the entire case through a different convening authority, time and resources were spent doing it. They didn't profit in any way. Not that that is a judicial concern of this court, but just to address the appellant's argument in regards to Salyer. Having said all that, thus dismissal without prejudice was the correct remedy in the court martial, and appellant is entitled to no relief under Castigar. Moving to the second issue, which is the Article 10 issue. The Barker factors have been widely recognized in our jurisprudence as the factors we look at to decide whether or not an Article 10 violation has occurred. And when balanced, the factors show that the government moved with reasonable diligence to try appellant as required by Article 10. Therefore, appellant's case should not be dismissed. And the first factor, the length of the delay, appellant points to large numbers, 382, 275, but
don't you point to 275?
I do, Your Honor, but I don't point to 275 to say that's the only number this court should look at. The cases are clear that you don't look at the number total and decide whether or not the government moved with reasonable diligence. The case law is clear that you look at periods broken down and look at those periods separately to decide whether or not the government moved reasonably with reasonable diligence to proceed towards trial and try the appellant.
What about with respect to the question of whether the number is sufficient to trigger? Is it a facially unreasonable delay?
So as far as that goes, yes. Yes, Your Honor. The analysis is obviously triggered, but...
You say obviously, but military judge number three, not so much.
Right, and I understand the standard review is de novo, and acknowledge that this court would find that number as facially unreasonable. But what I inartfully tried to do, Your Honor, is to counter the appellant's argument that the number alone is what this court should decide on whether or not this was reasonable in this case. And the case law is clear that that's not what has to happen. What has to happen is the periods are broken down. And this court looks at those periods separately to decide whether or not the government actively prosecuted the case to bring appellant to trial. And when broken down, the record supports that the government moved with reasonable diligence to bring appellant to trial. Initially, when entering pretrial confinement, appellant argues that he didn't know what he was charged with, and he sat in pretrial confinement for 60 days before learning that. But upon entering pretrial confinement, he was giving a copy of confinement order where he saw what the bases were for him entering into pretrial confinement. And also at the pretrial confinement hearing, he obviously heard all the evidence, that was supporting that. So he was informed of the charges and the nature of the offenses for which he was put into pretrial confinement for. And the 60 days that it took to prefer the charges was not facially unreasonable in this case either. The record's clear that this was initially a civilian case. The civilian authorities had jurisdiction over the case. They initially responded to the 911 call, interviewed appellant, and they did not see jurisdiction until the middle of September, and then they did not close their investigation until October. And shortly afterwards, they gave the investigative file to AFOSI. And at that point, AFOSI closed out their investigation, or started to close out their investigation. The government moved with reasonable diligence to still proceed to trial by preferring before AFOSI even closed out their report of investigation. So during this period of time, the government moved with reasonable diligence to move towards trial. Of course, there were periods where they were waiting on civilian authorities to provide additional information, but those periods, as Judge Dennis pointed out earlier in Ms. Gala, is not fatal. Those are just natural, that's just the way that investigations go sometimes, especially when you're relying on another authority to give you information.
So, counsel, how long would it have been reasonable to wait for the civilians to close their investigation, given that Chairman Laubach was in pretrial confinement? At some point, does it become unreasonable to wait for the civilians to close their investigation?
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor, it would be unreasonable. But in this case, this wasn't, as some of the language in Barker versus Wingo says, things like the court needs to take in consideration whether or not you have an ordinary street crime. And the government's position is aggravated assault with a deadly weapon would not be one of those crimes where they could easily decide whether or not they need to prefer. This would take longer investigation and steps to decide whether or not they are going to proceed. In fact, the government has the obligation to fully investigate a case to proceed towards trial.
So you said it takes a minute to decide whether you're going to prefer charges? I mean, it took about 48 hours to put him in pretrial confinement, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Military pretrial confinement after he was transferred from civilian confinement. But it took that much longer to decide if you were going to prefer charges this aggravated assault?
Well, Your Honor, at that point, they only had an allegation of aggravated assault. They didn't have all the evidence necessary to decide whether, they haven't fully investigated the case to decide whether or not they wanted to proceed towards trial. So the standard for placing someone in pretrial confinement and the standard for referral of charges are two different things. Also, under the circumstances of this case, it wouldn't be unreasonable. I understand, going back to your question, Senior Judge Johnson, that there would be a cap, obviously, of time, but the government's position is that due to the nature of this offense, it's not a simple larceny from the BX or something like that that they're deciding on. It's aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. And appellant pointed out the fact that the friend indicated an unwillingness to testify at trial, and that was one form of prejudice that he suffered. However, it's important to recognize that the friend was a military member, and despite his unwillingness to testify, the government could have ordered him to testify. Obviously, even if he was a civilian, he could have been subpoenaed to testify at trial. So his unwillingness should not play into this court's determination whether or not appellant may or may not have been prejudiced by that. And moving to some of the other numbers, from preferral to Article 32, this is the first time around. It took 26 days. Article 32 to referral took 15 days. Referral to trial took another 36 days. And I want to make it clear to the court that I have, in my numbers here, I've excluded 70 days due to defense delay. And I know in the brief, defense has posited that defense delays are due to the appellant, and he cites, are attributable to the government, and he cites Moreno for that position. But the case law is clear in the Article 10 context, in the Sixth Amendment context, that delays caused by the defendant are attributable to the defendant, and the case that I'm pointing to is Cooley in regards to that. After dismissal, without prejudice, the government then proceeded towards trial, and I want to point out that the CAF, or this court, has never said that due to a government mistake that everything after that is presumptively unreasonable. In fact, in Cooley, CAF decided whether or not the delay after a 707 violation, if the government still moved with reasonable diligence after a 707 violation. So in that case, the government did not proceed to trial within 120 days the first time around. The military judge dismissed the case without prejudice. And then after that, the government took another 5 months to get to trial. And nowhere in that case did CAF point to that 707 violation and say, this is the point where we're going to look at the government's actions with more scrutiny, or this basically says that anything that happened afterwards is presumptively unreasonable. Instead, what the court did in that case was looked at all the actions afterwards to decide if the government moved with reasonable diligence. And the court should do the same here. Despite this dismissal without prejudice due to the immunity issue, this court should not look at the case with more scrutiny. This court should look at all periods of time to decide whether or not the government moved with reasonable diligence. Also, this court should take into account that trial defense counsel requested dismissal without prejudice. I understand that he did not concede dismissal with prejudice was the remedy they were ultimately asking for, but he in fact requested the court to consider dismissal without prejudice and also recommended to the court what should happen, meaning the case should be transferred to another convening authority, another legal office should be firewalled off, and take steps to refer the case so that the appellant can have a taint-free case, is essentially what he said. So it's important for...
But that's about undoing the Castigar problem, right? He wasn't conceding speedy trial.
No, he wasn't. No, Your Honor. But I just wanted to point out that he did acknowledge that dismissal without prejudice would be an extreme remedy. So I say that so this court can recognize that remedy was not unreasonable. The military judge 2 did not make an unreasonable decision in granting the defense's request in part.
So we're back to issue 2.
I just wanted to point that out, Your Honor, because like Cooley, the court did not look at what the judge did to decide whether or not everything that happened afterwards was reasonably diligent or not, meaning there was no presumptiveness of unreasonableness on the government's part just because there was an issue in the middle. So when looking at the second trial, it took 29 days from dismissal of the case to reassignment. And obviously that required some coordination with a 4-star general's calendar. It's in the military judge's findings of fact about his time on station and those sorts of things. And I just would like to point the court's attention to these matters that the cases have recognized that operational necessities must be taken into account. From the new commander's review to preferral took 15 days after the case was reassigned. The preferral to Article 32 took 35 days. 11 days were due to defense delay. Article 32 report to referral took 18 days. And then after that, on 29 June, the defense told the government that they were not available for trial until September, and that's when trial was ultimately scheduled for September. So the government's position is that that period of time would also not be attributable to the government. But taking these all separately and analyzing these separately, the government moved with reasonable diligence to bring appellant to trial the first time and the second time.
Captain Kellett, I'd like to go back to the time frame where Global Strike legal office is trying to decide how to advise General Rand of the administrative reassignment. So the way I read the timeline is that that decision wasn't even made until 2 days before General Rand was on leave, somewhere in the 17th to 23rd of April 2017. Why did it take them that long to advise the four-star how to administratively reassign appellant?
Your Honor, I have no evidence from the record why it took them that long, but I would say that this was obviously probably a novel issue for the legal office, and it probably took them a while to figure out what they were ultimately going to recommend to General Rand. But should this court even find that short period of time unreasonable, I would say that short periods of inactivity, the cases have recognized that short periods of inactivity are not fatal to determine whether or not the government moved with reasonable diligence.
I'd also like you to address the last demand for speedy trial and the government's response to that as you move on to the next factor.
Do you mean the 29 June?
I do.
So, Your Honor, I would actually like to address each of these demands for speedy trial. In United States v. Kossman, the court stated that demands for speedy trial followed by a delay request should not be considered genuine demands. So to look at the context of when the demand was made and if defense counsel shortly afterwards requested a delay. And in this case, there are three demands for speedy trial, 28 October, 13 December, and 29 June. And in the first one, the government responded quickly to, in 28 October, the government responded to trial defense counsel's request or demand for speedy trial with a discovery response, and then the next day preferred charges and scheduled the Article 32. Now for the 13 December one, they again demanded speedy trial, but 2 days later, trial defense counsel requested a delay until March of 17. So we're looking at 3 months of delay there after just requesting speedy trial. And then on 29 June, when he demanded speedy trial, he also immediately stated that, or almost the same day, he stated that he would not be available for trial until September. So in regards to those demands for speedy trial, I would ask the court to recognize that while he did demand speedy trial, the government either moved with reasonable diligence to answer those demands, or defense counsel immediately stated they weren't available anyway to immediately proceed to trial. And I know I've just discussed the reasons for the delay, and I would like to move on now to prejudice. We kind of already addressed the demands for speedy trial, but moving to prejudice, appellant has failed to demonstrate prejudice under Barker. And under Barker, there are three things that the court looks at to determine if there was prejudice. One is oppressive pretrial incarceration. There was no intent to punish appellant in this case, and that's the focus of oppressive pretrial incarceration. And his conditions were not so egregious or oppressive that they amounted to an intent to punish. The military judge's finding of fact found that the only difference between a maximum medium custody confinee is that they could not apply for work details and that they just had to be escorted. They had the same day room privileges, that a medium custody confinee had, so therefore those conditions did not amount to an intent to punish.
How do you respond to appellant's argument that he was ineligible for additional work credits? Like, he ultimately had to spend more time in confinement because he couldn't have gotten the credit off of his confinement through work details that his post-trial confinees would have been eligible for.
Your Honor, I would say that he, in addressing pretrial confinement credit, he did get Allen credit, one for one credit, and he also got credit 105 days twice, so 210 total, while he was in confinement. Now, I'm not sure about the administrative details and requirements to get extra credit. I just don't have that information in front of me, like when they're entitled to that. But I would like to point out something that appellant said in regards to the pretrial confinement credit. 105 of those days were for the PCRO not being neutral and detached. But an additional 105 days were also credited because the PCRO abused its discretion by considering evidence that was outside the scope of the hearing. So it wasn't just because he was not found to be neutral or detached, and I just want to point that out for the court. Moving to the second part of prejudice is anxiety and concern. Appellant hasn't expressed any particular anxiety or concern not normally experienced by confinees, and he did know what he was charged with when he entered pretrial confinement. And there was no impairment to appellant's defense. This was not a case where witnesses' memories were subject or could have faded, because this was not a case based on a lot of eyewitness testimony. And I also would like to point out that there are other factors that this court can consider. Barker states that not only do you consider the four factors, but there are other circumstances that you consider that surround the speedy trial issue. And those factors would be that he was granted lots of pretrial confinement credit. He didn't sit in pretrial longer than the ultimately adjudged sentence, so he didn't serve more confinement than he would have anyway. Also, I would point this court's attention to United States v. Burge, which is a citation in the motion to supplement. And in that case, CAF looked at few factors that were not necessarily included in the Barker-Wingo factors. One is that appellant received credit for pretrial confinement on his sentence. Also, that there was no evidence of willful or malicious conduct on the part of the government to create the delay, nor did the government try to hamper the appellant's defense at trial. Also, appellant suffered no prejudice to the preparation of his case as a result of the delay. Thus, given the absence of prejudice, the 593 days of pretrial confinement credit, no evidence of willful or malicious conduct on the part of the government to create the delay, dismissal with prejudice would be a serious windfall for the appellant in this case, because the government proceeded with reasonable diligence to bring the appellant to trial. Accordingly, appellant is not entitled to relief. Pending any further questions from the court.
No, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, you may proceed.
I want to make three points in response to the government's argument. The first deals with prejudice. Ehrman Laubach is not as sanguine as the government is about the prejudice caused by the inclusion of his immunized testimony in the preferral and referral process. The government posed it during their argument that it was really just procedural and didn't have any impact. But despite bearing the burden under Castigar to show that there was no prejudice, the evidence in the record tends to indicate that there actually could have been prejudice due to that procedural mistake by the government. And I say mistake using the government's words. Obviously, it's Ehrman Laubach's position, it was intentional. The Article 32 hearing officer suggested that the case could be disposed of as a special court-martial. And as the government just talked about, there is no evidence presented about the immunized testimony at that Article 32. Yet, when it came time to do referral, that immunized testimony was included, and the government sought a general court-martial and ultimately got referral to a general court-martial. So we're talking about prejudice in the sense that Ehrman Laubach not only suffered prejudice in his confinement conditions, being in a segregated cell because he couldn't be couldn't be out in the common area with the others because they were medium security and he was maximum security. But we're also talking about prejudice of his substantive trial, both the preferral and referral stages, and when we get to sentencing. And even though the government may take a position that, well, there's no proof that that actually ended up causing that prejudice, that's not the standard that this court's supposed to use. The government actually bears the burden to prove that its misuse of CASCAR material didn't prejudice my client.
So what weight should or shouldn't we give to the declarations by the convening authorities that that wasn't a factor in their decision to send the case on?
Well, Your Honor, I think that you weigh that, but you know, it's certainly some evidence that maybe it wouldn't have pushed them one way or the other, but the problem is that they were also being advised by staff judge advocates who, whether they stated it or not, had knowledge of the immunized testimony as part of advising on referral. The second point is that the government's asking this court to find that they proceeded with reasonable diligence, despite 175 days being due solely to a CASCAR violation. Now, the government's 275-day concession doesn't include 31 days related to the processing of the second trial. So if you add those, if you say the second trial was only necessitated because the government violated CASCAR, which it was, and you add those 31 days to the 275 that they've already conceded to, you actually get a total of 311 days that, without fighting over defense delays or whether or not the referral was reasonable or not, you've got 311 days that this case was at the government's desk. Now, even though it's not applicable to an Article 10, RCM 707 times are 120 days. And that's not for an accused who's in pretrial confinement. That's for every accused. My client was held in pretrial confinement for roughly three times what RCM 707 says is appropriate for the same charge and specification. And third, I want to talk about how the government profited. The government profited both intentionally and it may have gotten some lucky rolls. This wasn't a mistake. My colleague, when he was up here, commented that this was a government mistake. This was no mistake. As military judge number two found in his findings of fact, this was intentional. This was purposeful. This was calculated. They talked up and down the chain about what they were about to do. And they used it the way they intended to. They intended to use it at the pretrial confinement hearing to secure confinement, and they did. And they succeeded. That's where they purposefully used it and gained from it. Now, whether they purposely gained and secured the testimony of a victim who they otherwise may not have is not clear, but once again, it's the government's job to disprove that prejudice. But at most, or at least, they profited unintentionally from their misconduct. Now, the government got up here and said, well, we could have forced them to testify anyhow, but what evidence is there of them of that they would actually have done that? And second, would the testimony have been the same if they put him up there and forced this victim up there versus him testifying of his own free will like he ended up doing a year later? This court should not hold that this was reasonable delay, but rather should hold the government accountable for the first time and send a message that it is not reasonable to violate an accused speedy trial and Fifth Amendment privileges and profit.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. The court will render its decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.